I wanna get locked up tonight. Listen to Rob Ross and get rock on my on the only podcast that I'll hear. Rip off my ears. Oh, the rock show, 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 the rock show. Oh, I want the rock show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Rock Show. I'm Rocker Mike. This is Rob Rossi right there on the left side. How you doing, Rob?
Pretty good.
Okay, episode 198. We're getting closer to 200, my man.
Yeah.
Okay, now you're on the right side.
Yeah, I moved it around.
Okay. Yeah, so we're getting close to 200. We have a very special show planned for that. There'll be more info about that soon. But this episode is about... What's that, Rob?
That show will be up in May.
May we will hit the 200.
This is the April show, right? This is an April show.
This is the first rock show for April.
All right.
And we're going to be talking today about a band that I've always liked. They've gone through some different incarnations. They're called The Cult. Okay. They've been around since the early 80s. Started out as the Southern Death Cult. And really, they've had top 40 success. Everybody knows a handful of songs from them. They're still around performing, putting out new music as of 2022, I believe was their last album. I saw them with my wife on that right before that album came out at Pier 17.
Yeah, they're still going, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Have you ever seen them?
No, I've never seen The Cult.
No, very good. You want to get into it now, right?
Start talking. This is the third time they reunited, right? They had three breakups.
Yeah, and you know, Ian Astbury, the lead singer, did some other side projects. I mean, for a brief period, he was actually playing with the Doors. When the Doors reformed, they needed a singer, and Ian actually sounds a little bit like Jim Morrison. So it was basically like the three surviving Doors. And at the point, and him doing the Jim Morrison role, and it was great.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't see it. It was tickets were through the roof for that. I couldn't do it. But I did see video of it, and it was pretty good. Very good.
All right, so let's get into it. Let's talk about The Cult.
All right, now, the origins of The Cult go back to 1981 in Bradford, Yorkshire, which is in England. That's where lead vocalist and main songwriter Ian Astbury came from. And he formed a band called the Southern Death Cult. And that name kind of was picked for a reason. It was derived from the academic term for Southern Death Cult, which is used to describe a cluster of 14th century Native American groups. Okay, it was something that he was very interested in. Now they refer it to as the Southeastern Ceremonial Complex. This is like a group of Southeastern Native American tribes, I guess you could say, or groups. It's also inspired from a very British thing, which is Northern and Southern England have some rivalry with each other politically and music-wise, bands. You know, North versus South, stuff like that. So they were calling themselves the Southern Death Cult in relation to Southern England, okay, which is where they were from. So Astbury was joined with guitarist Buzz Burrows, bassist Barry Jepsen, and drummer Aki Nawaz Qureshi. and they performed their first show as the Southern Death Cult on October 29th in 1981 in Bradford. The band were at the forefront of an emerging style, okay, that kind of was a mix of post-punk and gothic rock, a new thing like gothic. They were very, you know, they wore like frilly shirts and stuff like that. It was very gothic looking. And right away, they achieved a lot of critical success from the press, and they got a big fan following pretty much right away. They signed to two independent record labels. One was called Situation 2, and which was an offshoot of actually Beggar's Banquet. And they released a three-track triple A-side single, a song called Moya, during this period, and they toured through England headlining some of these shows with Bauhaus and a band called Theater of Hate. This was the gothic connection if they were playing with Bauhaus, right?
That's the way they got together, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, if they, you know, if you were having a gothic kind of crowd, you want to play with Bauhaus, you know?
Yeah.
Right. So that was the band Theater of Hate. They played with them, but Southern Death Cult would play their last gig, actually, in February of 83 in Manchester, after only 16 months of actually existing. Now, a compilation album entitled The Southern Death Cult was released, and this being a collection of the single radio sessions that they did for our old friend John Peel, okay, who we talk about so much, for Radio 1. And basically, one performance on here was actually recorded by an audience member with a tape recorder on this album. So it's very primitive. In April of 83, Astbury teamed up with guitarist Billy Duffy, who's one of my favorite guitarists. I think he's great. And they formed the band just called Death Cult. They took the Southern out. Okay. Now, Duffy had been in a band called the Nosebleeds. And you know who was also in Nosebleeds?
Who?
Morrissey. Prior to being in the Smiths. So there's a little connection there.
Yeah.
Okay. He was also in a band called Lonesome No More, and he was also in Theater of Hate as well. So in addition to Astbury and Duffy, the band also included bassist Jamie Stewart and drummer Raymond Taylor Smith, who later would change his name to Ray Mondo. Both from the Harrow area of London, and they both were from a punk band called Ritual. Death Cult made their live debut in Oslo, Sweden, right? Or Norway.
Yeah.
Norway. On July 25th, 1983, and also released the Death Cult EP in that same month. They then toured through mainland Europe, and in September 1983, Raimondo was deported to his home country of Sierra Leone and replaced by Nigel Preston, formerly of the band Theater of Hate, who Billy Duffy knew. The single called God's Zoo was released in October 1983. Another European tour with UK dates followed that fall. And to tone down their name's gothic connotations and gain broader appeal, the band would shorten their name again to just The Cult. And that would be January 1984, right before they appeared on a British Channel 4 television show called The Tube. The Cult's debut studio album was called Dreamtime, and it was recorded at Rockfield Studios in Wales in 1984. The record was to be produced by Joe Julian, but after recording the drum tracks, the band decided to replace him with John Brand. Brand produced the record, but guitarist Duffy has said the drum tracks were actually produced by Julian, as Preston had become unreliable at some point. The band recorded the songs, which later became known as Butterflies, The Gimmick, A Flower in the Desert, Horse Nation, Spirit Walker, Bad Medicine, Dreamtime, With Love, and that was later known as Ship of Fools, and also Sea and Sky, a song called Bone Bag, a song called Too Young, and another called 83rd Dream. There was also one untitled outtake in those sessions. Now, it's unknown what the outtake was, or whether it was developed into a song at a later date. Songs like Horse Nation showed Astbury's interest in Native American issues with the lyrics to Horse Nation. It went like, see them prancing, they come neighing to a horse nation. Taken almost verbatim from the book Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. Okay, that came out in 1970. While Spirit Walker dealt with shamanism, and the record's title and title track are overtly influenced by Australian Aboriginal beliefs. Their music was pretty deep. Okay, yeah. They were singing about a lot of interesting stuff. Now, on April 4th, 1984, the cult released the single.
Mike, category will you put this? Because I've never really thought they were like punk.
No, they're not punk.
No. They're like more like rock and roll.
Anybody that came out in the early 80s, they always lump that post-punk, especially from England, post-punk.
Yeah, they weren't punk to me at all, man. Yeah,
I mean, because that could be anything, all right? I mean, Duran was post-punk.
Duran was not punk at all. They were just rock and roll. Like, I think these guys are just rock and roll, you know?
Yeah. I mean, they would. I would say they kind of walked this line between like psychedelic 60s kind of sounding to hard rock. Okay. And, you know, but they, you know, what I like about them is they're kind of their own sound. They did kind of image wise, they kind of went back to the 60s, which, you know, songs like, you remember the video for Rain?
Yeah,
you know, here comes the rain, you know, with the everybody wearing the frilly shirts and the vests and the bell bottoms and all that. They would, you know, they were doing that whole thing. So, but they were also singing about, like, you know, American Indian stuff. Very interesting. They released the single Spirit Walker, which got to number one on the independent charts in the UK. That was on April 4th, 1984. And it kind of acted as a teaser for their new album, which would be called Dreamtime. This was followed that summer by a second single called Go West. Before the release of Dreamtime in September, the album reached number 21 in the UK and sold over 100,000 copies in the UK alone.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. On July 12, 1984, the band recorded five songs at the BBC Maida Vale 5 studio for a Richard Skinner session. Before and after the album's release, the cult toured throughout Europe and England before recording another single called Resurrection Joe. That got to number 74 in the UK. It was released that December. Now, following a Christmas support slot with Big Country, remember them, Big Country?
Yeah.
the cult toured Europe with support from another band called The Mission. And The Mission we talked about because they were an offshoot of the Sisters of Mercy. Okay, remember when the Sisters of Mercy split?
Yeah.
They became The Mission, and then later The Mission UK. Okay. Actually, they were also called The Sisterhood at one point, too. Now, Dreamtime was released initially only in the UK, but after its success and as the cult's popularity grew worldwide, it was issued in approximately 30 countries. Now, I can remember being about 15, 16, and listening to the old WLIR 92.7 here in New York, and they would be playing, you know, the cult. And it was before they had MTV videos or anything like that. There was a show called Off the Boat that would play these, like, British songs were out there. And that was one that they played every week, stuff from that Dreamtime.
You know, that was almost like 120 minutes, because that's what 120 minutes was like.
This was on the radio. Okay, yes. back when the radio was the radio. Okay,
yes. You
actually could hear things like that. MTV, a couple of years later, would go with 120 minutes because videos were so huge. This was that period where videos were just kicking in, you know, 83, like that. You know, so this is when now you would start to hear about the cult, at least in a big way. In May 1985, the cult released their fourth single, which was called She Sells Sanctuary. And that peaked at number 15 in the UK and spent 23 weeks in the top 100. The song was recently voted number 18 in VH1's Indie 100 of all time. In June 1985, following his increasingly erratic behavior, Preston was fired from the band. Big Country's drummer Mark Brzezicki was picked to replace Preston and was also included in the music video for She Sells Sanctuary. Mm-hmm. The Cult then finished recording their second studio album called Love in July and August 1985. The band's music and image shifted from their punk-oriented roots to a 1960s psychedelia influences. That's where they really started to kick in with that.
Yeah.
Love was a chart success, peaking at number 4 in the UK and selling 100,000 copies there. It did very well through the rest of Europe, selling 500,000 copies, 100,000 in Australia, and another 500,000 in the United States. Love reached number 20 on the charts in the Netherlands, where it remained for 32 weeks. To date, the record has sold over 2.5 million copies worldwide.
Wow.
If we ended the show right here, okay, Love would be one of my favorite albums.
Oh, okay. Yeah?
Yeah. I always seem to go back to it. It's something that, for me personally, I can remember walking into the old Ritz on 11th Street, now Webster Hall.
Yeah.
And I don't remember who I was going to see, to be honest with you. But I remember walking in, and they used to have a big movie screen in front of the stage before the bands would go on, and they would show like cartoons and shit like that. And then they would play music in the background. So I remember standing there watching old G-Force cartoons on this big screen. Okay. G-Force was a Battle of Planets. That was great shit. Okay. And they're playing this song and I'm hearing it. It's all this wah-wah and heavy sort of Stooges-ish. Okay. And I'm like, what? I went over to the, you know, somebody working there that was setting up. I said, who is this that you're playing? And they said, The Cult. And I said, that's not The Cult. It doesn't sound like them. They were kind of a little more punkish, you know, in the early years, a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. And he says, yeah, this is off the new album called Love. And it was a song called Phoenix. And I fell in love with it. And I remember going down to like Sullivan Street Records after that gig, because it used to be open late, and buying the album, you know, on vinyl.
That's cool.
You know, anyway, that's why I always love that album. But from late September 1985 to June of 1986, the band went on a worldwide tour for the Love album with their new drummer, Les Warner. They would replace drummers again. He had played with Julian Lennon and also Johnny Thunders. Two more singles from the Love album would follow, Rain, okay, that got to number 17 in the UK, a song called Revolution, which was sort of a ballad, okay, that charted in the UK at number 30. Neither charted in the US, those two, okay, but Rain was a video that got played a lot. It was like similar to the She Sells Sanctuary video, but it had like these backup singers and a lot of makeup, and they were doing a lot of like psychedelic, you know, bubbly kind of stuff with the girls singing and dancing around. And it was cool.
Those videos were great, man. They used to be so great.
Yeah, I always liked that one.
So these guys pretty much came out pretty strong off the bat, man. They were hit and people liked them because, you know, selling 100,000 album and 500, that's not easy, man, the business.
Not coming out of the gate, you know.
Yeah, coming out of the gate. So these guys came out pretty much swinging.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, they got an interesting past because they had changed their name twice before.
Yeah,
and changed their sound a little bit, and it just worked. Everything they did clicked. Ian Astbury's a great front man too. He's great to watch. You know, now the song "Here Comes the Rain" was actually used in the Italian horror film Demons 2, just as a little side note. Once back in England after the tour, the band booked themselves into the Manor Studios in Oxfordshire with producer Steve Brown, who had also produced Love, and they recorded over a dozen new songs that they wrote while on the tour. The band was kind of unhappy with the production of this new album they were trying to put together. It was titled Peace. Okay, and they decided to go to New York, and they connected with Rick Rubin, who remixed the first single called Love Removal Machine. Okay, one of their biggest hits. Now, Rubin agreed to work with this band, but only if they re-recorded the song. Okay, so Rubin eventually talked them into re-recording the entire album.
Wow.
All right. The band's record company, Beggar's Banquet, was very displeased about this, okay, as 2 months and £250,000 had already been spent on the record in the first recording. So the first single, Love Removal Machine, was released in February 1987, and the new version of the album appeared in April that year. Now it was renamed Electric, okay, and it reached number four, and eventually it outsold Love, the first one. So the band toured with Kid Chaos, who was also known as Haggis or the Kid, on bass guitar, and Stewart on rhythm guitar. Two more singles, a song called Little Devil and a song called Wildflower, were released during 1987. A few tracks from the original Peace album recordings appeared on the single versions of Love Removal Machine and Little Devil. The full Peace album would never see the light of day until the year 2000, when it was included as disc three of the Rare Cult box set. I've heard it. It's a different kind of sounding album than Electric. It's I could see why they probably didn't like it. It's not as, I saw them on that tour. Okay, it's the first time.
Was it good? Was it good or not good?
Opening for Billy Idol at Madison Square Garden. Okay. And I'll tell you a little story that I'll share with everybody. I got arrested before the show, okay, for scalping tickets. I was basically, I was supposed to take a girl to the show, and she bailed on me in the last minute, and I ended up with this extra ticket, and I thought I could get rid of it, and I got nailed by a cop and put in a trailer next to the garden. a bunch of other guys trying to sell tickets, and literally I had front row seats, which is why I wanted to sell it. I was like, okay, I had front row seats at the Garden, and literally like 10 minutes before the Cult was to go on, they let us out. They just screwed with us and held us there. Okay, so they let us go. I run into the Madison Square Garden, run through there. You know, I was cutting people. I was just trying to get to my seat.
I got
to
get in here.
Right. And as I sit down, the lights go out and the Cult comes on. And I think the first song they did was Wildflower. And it struck me that this album really sounds a lot like AC/DC. Okay. And I don't know. I mean, with Rick Rubin producing them, I guess that's not far of a stretch.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know if they were going for that sound, but they were very AC/DC-ish.
And that's the sound they got.
Yeah. So in the US, the Cult, now consisting of Ian Astbury, Billy Duffy, Stuart Warner, and Kid Chaos, was supported by a then unknown band called Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, I saw that.
Right? The band also appeared at Roskilde Festival in Denmark in June 1987. During the Australian part of the world tour, the band wrecked £30,000 worth of equipment, and as a result, they could not tour Japan as no company would rent them equipment. Okay. At the end of the Electric tour, okay, the album had been certified gold in the UK and sold roughly 3 million copies worldwide. But the band was barely speaking to each other at this point, okay? Haggis had left the band at the end of the tour to form a band called the Four Horsemen for Rubin's Deaf American label. Astbury and Duffy fired Warner and their management team, Grant Edwards, and moved to L.A. with original bassist Stewart.
Wow.
Warner sued the band several times for his firing, as well as for what he considered were unpaid royalties for his performance on the Electric album. There was a lot of lengthy court battles with this. The Cult signed a new management deal and wrote 21 new songs for their next record.
That's a lot of songs. And they also had, when you look at the history, they had a lot of band members.
They did. Well, I think Ian Astbury's, like a lot of talented genius people, they're a little difficult. Okay. So, you know, I'm sure they had a lot of reasons. There was a lot of drugs involved too, and things like that.
You would think, huh? Drugs?
Yeah, just a little bit. So, for the next studio album, Stewart returned and he was going to be playing bass. John Webster was brought in to play keyboards. The band used Chris Taylor to play drums during rehearsals and record the demos, with future Kiss drummer Eric Singer performing during the second demo recording. The Cult eventually recruited session drummer Mickey Curry to fill the drumming role, and Aerosmith sound engineer Bob Rock was brought in to produce the record. Recorded in Vancouver from October to December 1988 and released in April of 1989, Sonic Temple went top 10 in both the UK and the US, where it was certified gold and platinum, respectively. The band went on tour in support of the new album and new single Fire Woman. Remember that one? Okay. That was in the UK. That got to number 15. In New Zealand, it got to number one. They were also with a new drummer at that point, Matt Sorum, and Webster was brought in as a keyboardist. The next single, Edie, Chow Baby, got to number 25 in the UK and has become a regular song at concerts for many years. Both those songs, Edie and Fire Woman, you know, I can still remember constantly seeing the videos on MTV. Okay. That was something. It was like once an hour you were seeing that. And they went in a heavy direction kind of with that. Even heavier than electric. Kind of a precursor to grunge a little bit, I always thought. Fire Woman kind of had a little bit of a grungy feel to it, like a good year or two before grunge. And to hear that kind of song in the top 10, top 20 in America was a big deal.
It was a big deal.
I mean, hair metal was dying out. It was kind of filling this void of hard rock being played on the radio. It was a good song.
You know, the thing with that, these guys never had the same sound every time they did. And they would take an album like between every 2 years to every 3 years. You know, that's the way they look like the pattern. They'd take an album, but they never sounded the same in any of these albums.
Yeah. And I always find them interesting. Okay. You know, what are they coming out with now? You know,
yeah, so they reinvent themselves a lot.
Yeah, but never too much. You know, it's not like they're going, you know, totally different, but there seems to be a progression.
Yeah, it is a progression. You're right.
Now, in Europe, the band toured with Aerosmith. And in the U.S., after releasing another single, Sun King, they spent 1989 touring in support of Metallica. Okay. And that was, I remember Metallica, I think, asked for them, if I remember
that
right. I think they did. It wasn't just a record company thing. I think they wanted them. A fourth single, Sweet Soul Sister, which would get to number 38 in the UK, was released in February 1990, with the video having been filmed at Wembley Arena in November. Now, Sweet Soul Sister was partially written in Paris and was inspired by the very bohemian lifestyle of the city. Released as a single in February 1990, the song was another hit in the UK and reportedly reached number one on the rock charts in Brazil as well. After playing a show in Atlanta in February 1990, the band's management told Astaberry that his father had just died of cancer.
Oh, man.
As a result, the remainder of the tour was canceled after a final leg of shows were performed in April. After the tour ended, the band was on the verge of breaking up due to Stewart's retiring and moving to Canada to be with his wife. And Matt Sorum left to join Guns N' Roses. Okay.
The people were going on.
So in 1990, Astaberry organized the Gathering of the Tribes Festival in Los Angeles and San Francisco with artists like Soundgarden, Ice-T, Indigo Girls, Queen Latifah, Iggy Pop, The Charlatans, The Cramps, and Public Enemy. That's an interesting festival.
That is an interesting festival.
Yeah. Now, this 2-day festival drew in 40,000 people. Also in 1990, a 10-CD set was released in the UK containing rare songs from the Cult singles. The CDs in this box set were all issued as picture discs with rice paper, those thin rice paper covers, and housed in a white box called Singles Collection. It was also a black box called EP Collection 84 to 90. In 1991, director Oliver Stone offered Astaberry the role of Jim Morrison in Stone's film The Doors. Okay, obviously it would go to Val Kilmer. He declined the role because he was not happy with the way Jim Morrison was represented in the film, and Val Kilmer would, you know, take that position.
That was a good movie too.
I liked it. I thought it was all right. Yeah, I mean, I don't think they depicted him badly. I don't recall that. Yeah, but anyway, in 1991, Astaberry and Duffy were writing again for their next album, and during the demo recordings, Todd Hoffman and James Kottak played guitar. Played bass guitar and drums, respectively. During the actual album recording sessions, Curry was recruited again to play drums with Charlie Drayton on bass guitar and various other performers. Astaberry and Duffy's working relationship had kind of disintegrated by that time, with the two men even rarely being seen in the studio together, okay? The resulting studio album called Ceremony was released to mixed responses, okay? It kind of got mixed reviews. The album got to number 34 in the U.S., but sales were not as impressive as the previous three studio albums, only selling around 1 million copies worldwide. Only two official singles were released from the record, a track called Wild Hearted Son and a track called Heart of Soul. And a song called White was released as a single only in Canada. Sweet Salvation was released as a single. In Argentina, it was called Dulce Salvacion in 1992. And the title track Ceremony was released only in Spain as a single. The Cult's Ceremonial Stomp Tour went through Europe in 1991 and North America in 1992. In 91, the Cult played the London Marquee Club, okay, which was recorded and released in February of 1993. Packaged with some vinyl UK copies of their first greatest hits release. Only a handful of CD copies of it were ever manufactured originally, however. It was subsequently reissued on CD in 1999. And there's also an incomplete bootleg video of the show circulating around. The band was sued by the parents of the Native American boy pictured on the cover of Ceremony for alleged exploitation and for the unauthorized use of the child's image. The parents stated that the boy felt he had been cursed by the band's burning of his image and was emotionally scarred. This image of the boy is also burned in the video for Wild Hearted Son. This lawsuit delayed the release of Ceremony in many countries, including South Korea and Thailand, which did not see the record's release until late 1992. And it was unreleased in Turkey until the Cult played several shows in Istanbul in June of 1993. All that did not help sales. Okay.
Wow. Which is
why that album didn't do as good as the other three before. A world tour followed with backing from drummer Michael Lee, who had played with Page and Plant and a band called Little Angels. Bassist Kinley, also known as Barney Wolf, who played with Lord Tracy in Black Oak, Arkansas. And keyboardist John Sinclair, who played with Ozzy and Uriah Heep, returning one last time. And the Gathering of the Tribes moved to the UK this time. They were doing this festival. Here, artists like Pearl Jam performed. The warm-up gig to the show in a small nightclub was dedicated to the memory of Nigel Preston, who had died a few weeks earlier at the age of 28. Excuse me. Now, following the release of the single The Witch, number 9 in Australia, that got to, and the performance of a song for the 1992 Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie soundtrack entitled Zap City, produced by Steve Brown and originally was a B-side to Little Devil. Two volumes of remixes of She Sells Sanctuary called Sanctuary Mixes 1993, volumes 1 and 2, and in support of Pure Cult for Rockers, Ravers, Lovers, and Sinners, a greatest hits compilation, which debuted at number one on the British charts and later went to number one in Portugal. Astaberry and Duffy fired what they called their backing band and recruited Craig Adams from The Mission and Scott Garrett for performances across Europe in 1993, with some shows featuring Mike Dimkich on rhythm guitar. This tour marked the first time the band performed in Turkey, Greece, and the Slovak Republic.
So this guy's been on tour for a while now.
Non-stop.
A lot of bands start getting burned out. You know, you start getting inside.
Remember, they're all not getting along too good either.
Not getting along. The drug thing is getting worse. And
yep.
What do every band does after a while when this happens? They break up.
Yeah. Now, with the same lineup in place, the band released the self-titled The Cult in 1994. Yeah. And it was produced by Bob Rock. They brought him back. The self-titled studio album is commonly referred to as the Black Sheep album by fans of the group due to the image of a black sheep on the front cover. Astaberry referred to the record as a collection of very personal and very revealing songs about his life, with the subject matter ranging from sexual abuse at the age of 15 to the death of Nigel Preston, to his directionless years spent in Glasgow in the late 70s. The record achieved little success and only got to number 69 in the US and number 21 in the UK. Not too bad there.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Yeah, now Duffy remarked that he thought that the album wouldn't sell well due to the offensive lyrics. The record went to number one in Portugal also, but then quickly would drop out of sight. The single called Coming Down, Drug Tongue, in parentheses, was released with the band going on tour in support of the new album. Only one more single, a song called Star, was officially released with a live appearance on the UK TV show The Word. Star began life in 1986 as Tom Petty, that was the name of the song, and was recorded at the Sonic Temple demo sessions as a song called Star Child. It was then dropped by the band during rehearsals for that. So in 1993, the song was then resurrected and was finally completed for the record in 1994, just simply titled Star. When the band began the Beauties on the Streets tour in winter 1994, they augmented the lineup with James Stevenson on rhythm guitar, as with the Ceremony record several years earlier. No other official singles were released, but several other songs were released on a strictly limited basis. A song called Sacred Life was released in Spain and the Netherlands. Be Free was issued in Canada and France. Saints Are Down was issued in Greece, but none of the songs gained much commercial success. During this tour, the Cult made their first ever appearance in Norway, though they had played in Oslo as the Southern Death Cult. During the Black Rain tour of South America in spring of 1995, despite the fact that several more new songs had already been recorded, the tour was canceled after an appearance in Rio de Janeiro in March, and the band broke up citing unspecified problems on a recent South American tour.
So they broke up in the middle of tour. That's bad.
Yeah. Now, Astaberry started up a garage band called the Holy Barbarians a few months later. The band made their debut at the 100 Club in London in February of 96 and released their first and what will be their only studio album in May of 96, and toured throughout North America and Europe for the rest of 96. The band started writing and recording the band then started writing material for a second studio album in 1997, but Astaberry would dissolve the band and begin writing and recording a solo album. Throughout 1997 and 98, Astaberry recorded his debut solo album. It remained unreleased until June 2000, when it was released under the name Spirit, Light, and Speed. Astaberry played one solo concert in 1999. In November of 96, a number of CD reissues were released. The band's American record company released High Octane Cult, a slightly updated greatest hits compilation, released only in the US and in Japan. The Southern Death Cult, a remastered edition of the 15-song compilation CD, a 10-song compilation CD by Death Cult called Ghost Dance, consisting of the untitled 4-song EP, the single God Zoo, and four unreleased songs from a radio broadcast that they had done, and a remastered repackaging of the Dreamtime album, containing only the 10 original songs from the record in their original playing order and almost completely different by original artwork. Dreamtime Live at the Lyceum was also remastered and issued on video, and for the first time on CD, with the one unreleased song from the concert Gimmick.
So they were broken up, but they kept releasing songs.
Well, there was a lot of unreleased stuff out there, and the labels were putting this out. Okay.
Now, so what was the label doing? Remixing them themselves and just putting it out?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, when you're signed, everything you do during that time is the record companies, right? They could put it out.
Yeah, I guess so, because that sounds crazy, man. I hope they were making money out of that.
I'm sure they were making something, but they just weren't a band at this point.
Especially that they released it in Japan, and you know, they had to be big in Japan.
Yeah, they were. You know, just like everything else is big in Japan, they were big. So a reunion would be around the corner. In 1999, Astbury and Duffy reformed the Cult with Matt Sorum again and ex-Porno for Pyros bassist Martin Lenoble. Their first official concert was at the Tibetan Freedom Concert in June of 1999, after having rehearsed at shows in the L.A. area. The band's 1999 Cult Rising reunion tour resulted in a sold-out 30-day tour of the U.S., ending with 8 consecutive sold-out nights at the L.A. House of Blues. In 2000, the band toured South Africa for the first time, and North and South America, and contributed the song Painted on My Heart to the soundtrack of the movie Gone in 60 Seconds. The song was featured prominently, and the melody was fused into parts of the score. In June, Astbury's long-delayed debut solo album was finally released as Spirit, Light, and Speed, but it failed to gain much success. In November 2000, another authorized greatest hits compilation was released called Pure Cult, the singles 1984 through 95, along with an accompanying DVD, which was later certified gold in Canada. The Cult, as well as Ian Astbury, performed on separate tracks on the Doors tribute album Stoned Immaculate, the music of the Doors, covering Wild Child and Touch Me.
Wow.
In November 2000, Beggar's Banquet released 15,000 copies of a 6-disc box set with a bonus 7-disc of remixes for the first 5,000 copies, titled Rare Cult. The box set consists of album outtakes, demos, radio broadcasts, and album B-sides. It is most notable for including the previously unreleased Peace album in its entirety. In 2001, the band signed to Atlantic Records and recorded a new studio album called Beyond Good and Evil, originally being produced by Mick Jones of Foreigner, until Jones bowed out to tour with Foreigner. Astbury and Duffy co-wrote a song with Jones, which was an odd occurrence, as in the past, neither Astbury or Duffy would co-write their material. Bob Rock was the producer with Martin Lenoble and Chris Wise, as recording bassist, as Mike Dimkich played rhythm guitar on the tour, and Matt Sorum returned as the drummer. Although Sorum had previously toured with the band on the Sonic Temple tour in 89, this was the first time that he had recorded a studio album with the band.
So a lot of these guys would leave and come back.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so they must have been good term, you know?
Yeah, I mean, hey, look, money talks too, you know, who knows? Yes. You know, what they were doing, and put their differences aside and let's make a record. So, however, Beyond Good and Evil was not the comeback record the band had hoped for. Despite reaching number 37 in the U.S., number 22 in Canada, and number 25 in Spain, sales would pretty much drop off, only selling about 500,000 copies worldwide. The first single, called Rise, reached number 41 in the U.S. and number 2 on the mainstream rock charts. But Atlantic Records quickly pulled the song from radio playlists. Astbury would later describe the experience with Atlantic to be soul-destroying. After Atlantic tried to tamper with the lyrics, the record cover they tried to mess with, and choice of singles from the record. After the first single from the record, the band's working relationship with Atlantic Records was on paper only. With Atlantic pulling Rise from the radio station's playlists and stopping all promotion of the record. The second single, Breathe, was only released as a radio station promo, and the final single, True Believers, was only on a compilation sampler disc released in January of 2002 after the Cult's tour had already ended. Despite True Believers receiving radio airplay in Australia, both singles went mostly unnoticed, and both Astbury and Duffy walked away from the project. Lenoble rejoined the band for the initial dates in early 2001, and Billy Morrison filled in on bass guitar for the majority of the 2001 tour. The European of 2001 tour, European tour, canceled. They basically canceled that tour, largely due to security concerns after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And the band flew back to the U.S. to tour again with Aerosmith. But the 11-week tour was considered by fans to be a disaster, as the band only played a brief rundown of their greatest hits. In October 2001, a show at the Grand Olympic Auditorium in L.A. was filmed for release on DVD. After the tour ended in December 2001, the band took most of 2002 off, apart from a few shows in the U.S. to promote the release of the DVD, with Scott Garrick and Craig Adams rejoining the band at that point. Despite the commercial disappointment of Beyond Good and Evil and the supporting tour, the band was still voted Comeback of the Year by Metal Edge readers in the magazine's 2001 Reader's Choice Awards. In late 2002, Ian Astbury declared the Cult to be on ice indefinitely after performing a brief series of dates in October of that year to promote the release of the Music Without Fear DVD. During the second hiatus, Astbury performed as a member of The Doors, later dubbed The Doors of the 21st Century, later dubbed again D21C, most recently known as Riders on the Storm. With two of the original members of that group, D21C was sued numerous times by Jim Morrison's family and by drummer John Densmore, who was not part of the project. I misspoke earlier, and I think I said he was. He wasn't. Astbury supposedly started work on recording another solo studio album that later became the backbone for the Cult's Born Into This in 2007. Those Door shows, they were like, I think they played Irving Plaza. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And they were charging, like, at the time, like $300-$400 a ticket.
Ooh.
It was a lot. It just, I don't know. Ian Astbury's great, but I can see why they picked him to do Morrison, but I don't know how that worked out. I've seen video of it. It's pretty good, but I don't know, live. I wasn't going to spend that kind of money, you know? What do you think?
So far, so good. All right. But there's a lot of history here.
There's a lot.
I didn't even know the whole thing that they did the Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, yeah. Now,
and Gran Turismo, too. I was reading.
Yeah. Now, there would be a second reunion soon. It was called Born Into This. That would be the first album they would put out. Now, despite Astbury's previous statement from 2004 that the band was on ice, the Cult announced in January of 2006 that they were reuniting for some limited gigs. A month later, the band made their first live appearance in 3.5 years on the Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson. The lineup was Astbury on lead vocals, Duffy on lead guitar, John Tempesta on drums, Dim Kitch was back on rhythm guitar, and Weiss was returning as bassist.
Thanks.
Their first stage show was held in March 2006 in San Francisco, California, at the Fillmore. The entire tour was recorded by Instant Live and sold after each show. In May, they did an 8-date tour in Canada. Later that summer, they toured Central and Eastern Europe and played their first concerts in Bulgaria, Poland, and Serbia. An 11-date UK tour followed, as well as several more dates in the United States, finishing with a South American tour in December. That year, Duffy began a new band called Circus Diablo with Billy Morrison, Matt Sorum, Brett Scallions, and Ricky Warwick. During these tours, the band occasionally played an extended set, including several songs the band had not performed in decades. King Contrary Man, Hollow Man, neither of which had been performed since like 1987. Also, Libertine was performed approximately 3 times for the first time since 2000. Brother Wolf and Sister Moon off the Love album, which was only performed one time since 1986. They played like a an abridged version of the song. Okay, very cool track off the Love album. Astaberry announced in February of 2007 that he was leaving Riders on the Storm and returning to the Cult. Riders on the Storm being the Doors band. He stated, "I have decided to move on and focus on my own music and legacy." The Cult was featured on StuffMagazines.com list of ultimate air guitar players. On March 21st, 2007, it was announced that the band will be touring Europe with The Who. The first date was in Rotterdam, then the Netherlands, in early June, with at least a dozen shows set to follow. The band played a gig in London's West End at the CC Club on June 7, 2007, along with nearly two dozen shows across continental Europe during the summer. The tour also includes the first performance in Romania and Croatia. On May 29, 2007, the band signed a deal with major metal label Roadrunner Records. Their eighth studio album, titled Born Into This, was released on October 16th of 2007 and was produced by Martin Youth Glover, bassist for the band Killing Joke. Born Into This was released as a regular single disc and limited edition double disc, the second disc being a five-track bonus CD holding the following tracks: Stand Alone, War Pony Destroyer, I Assassin, Sound of Destruction, and a song called Savages. Prior to the album's release, the band played festival and headline dates and supported The Who in Europe. That was through the summer of 2007, with a U.S. headline tour to follow. The band's appearance at Irving Plaza in New York City in early November of 2006 was filmed and was released in 2007 as The Cult New York City, issued by Fontana North, and is The Cult's first high-definition DVD release. Meanwhile, Astaberry lent his vocals on two tracks of the 2007 Uncle studio album, War Stories, one of them being the first single from the album, Burn My Shadow. Band was called Uncle, U-N-K-L-E. Very interesting band. The band then performed a UK and European tour in late February and early March 2008. On 24th of March, they began their North American tour, including a major 13-city tour in Canada. During September...
They did a lot of touring. Holy crap.
A lot of touring. Their whole career.
Yeah.
During September 2008, the Cult did a brief series of dates in the Northeast United States, and they toured in Brazil as part of the South American tour in 2008, October of that year. As of May 2008, according to The Gauntlet, the Cult is currently unsigned and no longer under contract with Roadrunner Records. In October of 2008, it was announced that the Cult would headline the inaugural Rock and Roll Marathon in San Antonio to be run November 16, 2008. The Cult announced plans for a tour showcasing their 1985 Love album across the U.S. and then the U.K. in October, where they will play at the Royal Albert Hall. Coinciding with the remastered Love album and four-disc Omnibus boxed set, the Cult kicked off the long-awaited Love Live Tour in late summer, performing their classic album Love in its entirety. Each show was played with the Love tracks opening with Nirvana to Black Angel. A quick intermission followed, then other Cult hits were played, which would vary at every show. Songs like Sun King, Dirty Little Rockstar, Electric Ocean, Illuminated, then followed the favorites like Fire Woman, Little Devil, Wildflower, and lastly, Love Removal Machine. In the evening of October 10, 2009, at the Royal Albert Hall in London, the band performed a second encore with original Cult bassist Jamie Stewart and the drummer Mark Brzezinski, who played drums with the band during the Love album recording sessions in July and August of 85. The band sold Love Live USB flash drives for each show during the tour.
Wow.
Pretty smart, right?
Pretty inventive.
Yeah. Probably pretty cheap, too.
Yeah.
The Cult entered 2010, continuing their Love Live tour and announcing more dates in the United States, New Zealand, Australia, and Japan. The band finished recording a four-track capsule okay, with producer Chris Goss. Capsule 1 was said to be the first of three or four to be released sometime in September 2010. Release formats included CD, DVD, dual disc, 12-inch vinyl, and digital downloads. Wow. Capsule 1 was released on September 14, 2010. The band officially announced the release of its first new studio recording since 2007, a song called Every Man and Woman is a Star. The new single was released through the iTunes Store on July 31st, 2010. On August 1st, 2010, the band played the sold-out music festival Sonosphere, which marked their first UK performance since the tour of their Love album. During the performance, they debuted their new single, Every Man and Woman is a Star, which was released on August 1st, 2010. On the 14th of September, 2010, the band embarked on a new U.S. tour and released Capsule 1 in conjunction with media technology company Adara Inc. and made it available in multiple formats, including a CD, DVD, dual disc, USB flash drive, also a 12-inch vinyl, an FLAC download, an MP3 download. What's an FLAC download, Rob?
I don't even know. I have no idea what that is. That's probably another format, like an MP3 or something you can download.
FLAC.
That's what it is.
Yeah, I never heard of that. So the collection includes a short film made by Ian Astbury and Rick Rogers. On October 26, 2010, the band and Adara Incorporated announced the release of a new song called Embers for the first November of 2010. And Capsule 2 was available through their web store on November 16, 2010. Pictures from the Cult's tour stop in Chicago on the 20th of October can be seen at local radio stations, at a local radio station's website. Now, on 17th of September 2010, the band performed live at the Fall Frenzy concert at the Tempe Beach Park in Tempe, Arizona. Other bands that played at this concert were the Stone Temple Pilots, Shinedown, and Seven. Wow. Right. On December 4th, 2010, the band performed a live set for Guitar Center Sessions on DirecTV. The episode included an interview with the band by program host Nick Harcourt. During the Cult's concert at the Hammersmith Apollo in London on January 21st, 2011, Ian Astbury declared that the Cult will be recording a new studio album directly after the tour. They also announced that they would be working with Chris Goss, who performed with Masters of Reality as an opening act that same evening. On 11th of May, 2011, it was announced that the Cult was signed to Cooking Vinyl Records, who would release the new studio album in 2012. Commented guitarist Billy Duffy, he said, "We are very much looking forward to returning to our UK roots in many ways, working with Cooking Vinyl." Ian Astbury added, "We look forward to a long and fruitful relationship with Cooking Vinyl." By May 2011, the band had been writing and recording new demos at its Witch Mountain studio, Hideaway, that is in the Hollywood Hills, and began recording their new album at Hollywood Recording Studios. In October of 2011, bassist Chris Wise stated the album was almost finished and expected to be released in April of 2012. Weiss also described it as a Zeppelin Stooges mix of energy. On the 29th of November 2011, it was announced that the album would be produced by Bob Rock, who had done Sonic Temple, The Cult, and Beyond Good and Evil. The studio album entitled Choice of Weapon was released on the 22nd of May of 2012. The band partnered with Rolling Stone to premiere the first song from the album titled Lucifer on January 30th. On February 5th, 2012, the Cult song She Sells Sanctuary was used in a Budweiser beer commercial in a mashup with Flo Rida, aired during the Super Bowl 46. Do you recall that? I don't remember that.
I do not remember that.
In a Budweiser commercial for the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I don't remember that at all.
I have to look that up. It's probably lumped up watching the game.
That was on February 5th, 2012. I got to say, the Cult song, She's So Sad, was used to the soundtrack of a Budweiser beer commercial in a matchup with Flo Rida. But it was a matchup with Flo Rida.
Yeah, I get it. Oh, Flo Rida is a rapper?
Yeah.
All right. I don't remember this, but it kind of rings a bell a little bit. In May of 2012, the Cult appeared on Jimmy Kimmel, all right, and played the song For the Animals. on September 28, 2012, it was announced that the band would release the album Weapon of Choice, and it was considered a prequel album to accompany the band's latest studio album, Choice of Weapon. Mm. Weapon of Choice, Choice of Weapon.
The Weapon.
The digital-only release, available exclusively on iTunes for 2 months only beginning October 16th, features the songs that were ultimately included in Choice of Weapon at an earlier stage of development. Explaining the motivations behind the release, lead vocalist Ian Astbury said that these songs were turned over and over, forged in long rehearsals and writing sessions, and emanated from challenges both personal and professional. We put our guts into this. Producer Chris Goss was able to create an environment where the songs were born through playing and turning over lyrics, though through hard work and intense sessions. Astbury added, "These songs have an integrity and rawness of their own. In many ways, it's a different album to the one we released and reveals the foundations of Choice of Weapon. We were able to close the doors and begin to explore spaces we had not been in for a while." The song Twisted and Bleeding was made available for free download at the band's website ahead of the full digital release. On June 20th, 2013, the band announced the release of Electric Peace, which comprises the entire Electric album, plus the Peace album, which was only previously released on the now out-of-print Rare Cult box set in 2000. It was released in the U.S. on July 30th. In 2013, Mike Dimkich left the band and joined Bad Religion to cover for guitarist Greg Henson. James Stevenson from the Beauties on the Streets tour in 1994 replaced Dimkich as the Cult's rhythm guitarist. In March 2013, Billy Duffy told the Argentine journalist Fabrizio Pedrotti that the Cult had begun work on a new studio album, possibly for a 2014 release.
A lot of albums, man.
Yep, the band were expected to begin work on the album after they finished their 2013 world tour, where they played the Electric album in its entirety. In August 2014, Duffy added that the next album, which was not expected to be released before 2015 at the earliest, will be more guitar-heavy in the past than stuff they had done, you know, in the past. On November 5th, 2015, it was announced that the Cult would release their new studio album entitled Hidden City on February 5th of 2016. The album is said to be the final part of a trilogy that began with Born Into This and marks the fifth time Bob Rock had produced a Cult album. The band also announced that they had hired Australian-born bassist Grant Fitzpatrick as the replacement for Chris Weiss. Chris Chaney, who was formerly in Jane's Addiction, and producer Bob Rock performed sessions based on the album. In support of Hidden City, the Cult opened for Guns N' Roses on the Not In This Lifetime tour. Oof. Funny how they had Guns N' Roses opening for them at one point, and then they ended up
opening for Guns N' Roses.
Yeah. In an October 2016 interview with Pop Matters, journalist J.C. Masick III, Cult guitarist Billy Duffy spoke of the band's playlist while on tour, saying, "Obviously, you want to make an impactful show. There are some practical, pragmatic decisions made. If you're playing to a crowd who are not very familiar with you, there's no point of going too deep. But we do always make sure we play a new song. Like on Guns N' Roses, on the Guns N' Roses tour, we had 50 minutes, which is 10 songs all in. So, you know, we just made sure that in those 10 songs we played Deeply Ordered Chaos," which that's a new song that they're proud of, and it makes a certain statement. And it just alerts people to the fact that, yes, we have made a record in the last 30 years.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he says, you know, and that's a good thing. Psychologically, that's the blood transfusion that we need. And we're very mindful. We have a very loyal fan base. We don't pander as well, as you know. Okay. So basically, he's saying, you know, we play the hits, but we got to throw in a new song or two.
A new song, yeah.
To show that we're still relevant, you know.
But that's like break bands, because sometimes they like people like to hear the old songs, you know.
Well, you know, you're always going to have people in the audience that are there that don't know anything but the hits.
Yeah, I always love when band play like an album. They'll tell you, "We're going to play this album," and you from can go to the concert, you listen to the songs you really want.
Yeah, because, you know, for instance, the Love album, so many of those songs were never performed live, or only were when Love first came out.
Yeah.
and you know, to hear it in its entirety in the order like the album is, you know, it's great.
Yeah, that's awesome. What they do. I love what dude.
That's something a lot of bands have been doing now. That's like a
Pearl
thing.
Pearl Jam did that to the album 10.
Yes.
They did that whole album and sold out. Every song there was good that people loved.
The first guy I ever heard to do that in memory was Lou Reed. I saw him in 1989 for the New York album tour, called New York. And he even said, like, this album has to be heard from beginning to end. You can't take pieces out of it. So he did it from beginning to end and then did some greatest hits at the end as an encore. I think that was the first time I'd ever heard anybody do that, you know, so it was pretty cool. But getting back to the Cult, we're now in 2018.
Yeah.
You know, Billy Duffy was asked by Guitar World if there would be another studio album soon. And he replied, never say never. Okay. Ian and I enjoy the process of making new music. You know, and later they would do a tour called the Revolution 3 Tour. And they performed as one of three headliners along with Stone Temple Pilots and Bush. I remember that tour. In April of 2019, the Cult announced that they would celebrate the 30th anniversary of the release of their fourth studio album, Sonic Temple, with a world tour, which began on May 2nd in Houston and was expected to wrap up in 2020. In June 2019, interview with LA Weekly, lead vocalist Ian Astbury stated that the Cult were long overdue to release new music. He was quoted as saying, "We do have some stuff we've been working on, but it's yet to see the light of day." 6 months later, Astbury told Atlantic City Weekly that the band was going to start working on new music in 2020. He said, "We've got a few pieces lying around in various stages of completion. The intention is to get together in the new year and take a look at what we've got and decide on how we are going to go about moving forward. It's an essential part of any creative lifeblood. On May 6, 2020, the Cult announced on their Twitter page that they had signed to Black Hill Records. On August 15, 2020, Duffy announced on his Twitter that the band were recording their 11th studio album with producer Tom Dougherty at Rockfield Studios, where the Cult had recorded their debut studio album, Dreamtime, 36 years earlier. Progress was slow for nearly 2 years, hampered by COVID, of course, and the album being recorded remotely with half the band tracking it at Rockfield Studios in Astbury, living in the United States. In May 2022, Duffy told the Yorkshire Post that the main bulk of the album was finished and mastered. July 7th of 2022, the band announced Under the Midnight as the title of their album, released on the 7th of October, and Give Me Mercy was released its first single. Now, in between that time, July and October, I saw them with my wife at Pier 17.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, at Pier 17, and that was fucking great. The opening band was the Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. I love those guys too. Okay, so to see these two bands live back to back in the same show was great. Ian Astbury kicked ass. We had a good shot, you know, a good spot, I should say, close to the stage on the Billy Duffy side. And, you know, Duffy had that white Gretsch he always plays, like in the videos and stuff. And Astbury looked great. I think he had a bandana on like he always wears. And he was fucking with the audience. He was telling everybody, "Hey, this is New York, you know. You got to dance. You got to do this. You got to, you know."
I love
it. Rile everybody up. It was good. I had a good time. Prior to the release of that album, the Cult embarked on a co-headlining 6-date tour, the UK tour with Alice Cooper and a band called Creeper. All right. And then they went on tour in North America with Black Rebel Motorcycle Club and a band called Zola Jesus. I missed Zola Jesus that night. That was like the opening act. On August 14th of 2023, Astbury and Duffy announced a 12-day tour of the UK, along with a single US date in LA under the title Death Cult 8323. Whilst concentrating on the Death Cult material, the shows also covered Southern Death Cult and the Cult's first two albums, Dreamtime and Love. On the 5th of October 2023, the Spokesman Review reported that the Cult had been working on new material for a possible 2024 release.
So they're still making albums.
Still making albums, kicking ass.
Which means this 2024 release will probably be released in 2026. The way they're going now.
Yep, yep. So that's what I got today, Rob.
Holy shit, what a history, my God, man.
Yep.
That was a lot of information. Everybody was like, Mike, how you get all that information, man? And that stuff that you know and stuff that come out.
Stuff I know, mixing in with research, it's good.
Yeah, it was a lot, man. That was like, holy shit. I know way too much of the fucking cult.
You'll never see them the same again, right?
I will never see them again. I always thought they're like one of those bands that they got some decent song and stuff. But if I never heard them, I'd be like, okay. But then you hear one or two songs, you're like, wow, these guys are great. It's like one of those bands that it's like some people either love them or hate them.
Yeah, I always go back to the Love Record.
Yeah.
Songs like Nirvana, Brother Sun, Sister Moon, Brother Wolf, Sister Moon. I mean, Phoenix, She Sells Sanctuary. You know, I mean, it's like, it's a perfect record. I love that album.
That is a good album. That's definitely one of those. Do you ever put into these albums you need to hear before you die?
Oh, I think that might be too big an album to do for that, right? So many people. It sold millions. I think everybody has heard it.
It should be in that list. I don't think you ever mentioned that.
No, maybe I didn't. I you know, those lists are very tough to put together. You kind of walk this line between something that.
I think you can easily do a top 50 of 50 songs you should listen before you die.
But you know, you don't want them to be too popular.
50 albums, I mean.
Yeah, you don't want them to be like a song that everybody knows. You know, you want it to be something that you need to hear. You know what I mean?
No, I mean the albums, not songs.
Album. Either way, you know, albums that you need to hear.
Yeah.
So those lists are always fun to do.
I'm surprised you never brought Love the record. Maybe this year makes it this.
Maybe. Well, we got to think about that. We got plenty of rock shows left for the year.
Yeah, because we got to do that because that's one of the ones that people like that we do every year. We pick 10 albums. And people go, wow, this album is really great. Amazing.
Yep.
Or people come up to me, have you heard the album? I didn't hear it until Mike told me to listen to it. All right, Michael, where do people find you?
Okay, if you're looking for me, I'm all over social media, Facebook. I'm under Rocko Mike, not Rocker Mike, Rocko Mike. I'm also, we got the Rock Show Podcast group page on Facebook. Very active on that with, I think, close to 3,000 members now.
There's a lot of members, man. I got to go in there every day and allow people because there's so many people joining or people that want to say something or put something up.
Yeah, there's also been some assholes posting porn and stuff that I've had to pull out of there and get them out, you know, get us in trouble. But, and of course, you can find me on Instagram, RockerMike212, on X, formerly Twitter, RockerMike212. I'm on CloudHub, MeWe, True Social, Getter under RockerMike. Where can we find you, Rob?
And you can find me on Facebook, X. Instagram and the Rock Show, the Rocker Mike and Rock Show page, and you can also find me on YouTube, the YouTube channel.
Yeah,
if you're watching this show, subscribe and like so we can get the most subscribers we get, the more likes and view we get, the better the show we get because we get more people, and hopefully, we can make this monetize this channel so. People can enjoy some of the work we do and buy some equipment and stuff. So pretty much we work pretty hard. We've been doing this for 5 years. We're coming up to the 200th show. It'll be an episodic episode.
Definitely. And next episode, we're doing a making of. We haven't done that in a while.
The making of the Sex Pistols. That should be interesting.
Never mind the Bollocks album. Yep.
You know, and also that's the God Save the Queen, right?
It's all on there. In the UK, all that.
All right, people. So remember, don't get drunk.
And get lumped up.
And Mike, what you always say?
Take care, people.
get locked up tonight. Listen to Rob Ross and get rock on mine. On the only podcast that I'll hear, that won't make me wanna rip off my ears. Oh, the Rock Show, the Rock Show.